KALW.
And I realized something. If I hate my dad, I hate myself. If I love myself, I love my dad. Because I am my dad.
Incarcerated men reflect on their relationships with their fathers and their sons.
Being a father and not being able to like step up like I want to, I feel like this is the perfect opportunity to have my father step up like he should have.
The second episode of the series Uncuffed, and we'll hear how the climate science community is talking about the wildfires.
Fires that in past decades might have been a news footnote have the potential to now be a devastating public disaster if they move into populated areas.
Stay tuned, Cross Currents is coming up. California is getting an energy czar. That's according to Governor Gavin Newsom, who announced a big reshaping of the utility company PG&E in response to the state's ongoing wildfire crisis. Many experts believe the recent disasters represent a new era, one in which major wildfires that threaten people and their homes are a regular fixture in our lives. A changing environment may need a new set of responses from our communities and our government. Chris Field is director of the Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment. I called him up to see how the scientific community is thinking about wildfires. You've been studying this for a long time. Are you seeing anything new that has surprised you?
For sure. The ferocity of the fires has increased dramatically. The number of structures burned, the number of people lost. We really have seen a massive uptick. California has a lot more people who live in what we call the wildland-urban interface. And fires that in past decades might have been sort of a news footnote have the potential to now be a devastating public disaster if they move into populated areas.
What are some examples in the Bay Area of these areas you're talking about?
Well, I personally live in a wildland-urban interface just to the west of the Stanford campus. Wherever you see subdivisions that kind of move out of the, curbs and gutters kind of 1950s subdivision into a more scattered through the forest, and we see it, extensively in the hills of Oakland or in Marin County, all along the peninsula where the houses drift up into the mountains. Those are very fire-prone areas where the risks of catastrophic wildfire are really quite high.
What have you been doing then, you, your neighbors? Is there anything specific that you have been doing?
Yes. In fact, a lot of the steps to make communities more fire-resistant are relatively straightforward. Some of the most important ones involve making sure that your house meets the wildland urban interface building code. Things like emphasizing a defensible space around the home, having shrubs and trees be far enough so that they're not igniting the house and so that firefighters have access. Even simple things like making sure that there's not an accumulation of leaves and pine needles on your roof can make a big difference about whether your house catches on fire when a spark hits it. So there are lots of things that can happen, and they range all the way from steps that individual homeowners can take to the power company being attentive to making sure there aren't limbs hanging over the power lines, to making sure that the fire department has really good access if a fire does occur.
And where do you see this going? Do you see it getting better at all? Do you think, you know, people and but also, you know, the county level and at the state level are getting it right so that we will be moving in the right direction?
We are living in the midst of a genuine catastrophe in California where the amount of economic damage and the amount loss of life from wildfires, totally unacceptable, and some things need to change. Some of them are steps that individual homeowners can take, but others have to be taken at the level of statewide initiatives to do things like reduce these levels of fuel that are accumulated, brush on the ground, dead limbs, small trees, fuel that could carry a fire from the ground up into the tops of the trees where it has the potential to spread long distances and become devastating, make the power grid safer, and enhance our emergency responses. And in some cases, we may even decide that some communities are at such great fire risk that it's really not responsible to continue to allow people to live in some of these places. And so there may be selected places in California where we need to either rearrange neighborhoods or potentially even find ways for whole communities to start over in another location.
What would you ideally, in an ideal world, like to see happen in 2020?
We need to be reducing the risk of catastrophic fire by using fire as a tool to reduce these fuels. Our targets for using managed low-intensity fire to reduce the fuels, call it prescribed burns, is much, much higher than the level we're actually burning at. And we should be increasing that level by at least a factor of 10 so that we can get ahead of this fuel accumulation.
Why is prescribed burning so important?
So one of the things that research has shown is that we can reduce these fuel accumulations, the things that increase the risk of catastrophic fires, by using fire as a tool. I know that sounds unexpected, but there's a huge amount of experience around the country and around the world that purposely set fires, called prescribed burns, can be very effective at reducing these very dangerous fuels, and they can do it in a way that has a manageable ground level fire, very low risk to the whole forest and low risk to surrounding communities. They can even be managed in a way where the smoke production is minimal, in a way that very effectively reduces the amount of fuels. And fire can do fuel reduction at a much, much lower cost than having individuals have to go into these forests with chainsaws and tractors. And if we can use fire as an ally in preventing fire and fighting fire, it's going to get us way ahead of the game in the long run. So one of the most important things for California to do is dramatically increase the amount of prescribed burn that it uses to decrease the risk of catastrophic wildfire. Cal Fire has been ambitious about that, but there's a lot more that needs to be done. At the same time, we should continue to insist that the utilities like PG&E make their infrastructure safer. We should figure out how to deal more effectively with the public safety power shutdowns that really are likely to provide an increase in fire safety. And we also need to encourage communities and individual homeowners to make their properties as safe as possible.
Chris Field is director of the Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment, and thanks to Christopher Agusa, who helped produce that interview. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Now we're going to bring you the second episode of our new series, Uncuffed, recorded and produced by our partners in California prisons. Today's show comes from the crew at San Quentin. It's about love, family, and baseball.
So I'm here in the Media Center today, a place I've been coming to for the past 7 years. I've spent countless hours down here producing radio stories. This is Uncuffed, a project created by incarcerated people at San Quentin and Solano State Prisons. I'm Greg Eskridge, And I'm coming at you today from the San Quentin side of the world. So I'm excited to be here today with some of my co-producers, some of the fellas down here in the studio. Today with me, I have Shakur.
What it do?
Edmund.
What's going on, y'all?
And Bun.
What's up?
All right, well, how y'all doing today, man? What's going on with y'all, man? What's up with everybody? How y'all doing?
We chilling right now,
yeah,
man.
All is well.
So I asked you guys to come here today because I want to play this story for you guys I produced, and I want to talk about it a little bit. One thing that this story brought up for me was the idea of coming back to something you love. So, for example, I remember when I was young, right? My uncle used to, you know, he was like a carpenter, like a mechanic, and, you know, he was one of those real handy men, right? And so I used to love playing with those tools and being around him and, like, my step-pops, right?
Sure.
And so for years, I got away from that. Mm-hmm. And so recently, about, I'll say maybe about a year and a half, 2 years ago, I got a job in the plumbing shop. Mm-hmm. And, man, when I got around those tools, I was like a little kid again, man. You know what I mean?
Okay.
I felt like a little kid when I got my hand on the vice grips and the wrenches and the hammer. Man, I was in there trying to take apart everything. You know what I mean? So my question to y'all today, man, so what is something that you once loved and got away from, and now you found yourself back at that love again? Edmund, go ahead and start us off, bro.
Man, for me, I remember I used to love basketball. Middle school, played it every day. Mm-hmm. When I got into high school, you know, that's that. At an adolescence age, you start liking girls, you like really trying to find out who you are and how you fit in. Like, and I stopped playing basketball. So when I came back to prison in 2012, just thinking I still had it, I stepped back onto the basketball court. And like, I'm doing my stuff. And I'm jumping so high. Like, literally, look, I'm 5'6", but I can pretty much get my forearm over the rim.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? This is how high I'm jumping.
Like Spud Webb?
So it's like, man, and I come back down, and I land on my ankle, and it breaks.
Oh, man.
Man, but I love basketball so much, man. Like, I'm willing to, like, sustain injuries, heal, and just come right back to it. That's how much I love that sport.
So the reason why I asked you this question was because I did a story about Cleo Kloman, right? Mm. And actually the story was called Restoring Family. So I met Cleo here in San Quentin, and Cleo told me that he once had a real love for baseball when he was young, but got away from that love of baseball. And also, he talked about his father and how he was able to rebuild that relationship.
Mm. Okay. Yeah, so here first play, man.
So here it is, Restoring Family.
Here we go.
So my family life was a blessing and a curse. I had both of my parents as a blessing. My mother and my father, they was there. The curse was that there was addiction in my household, particularly by my father. He was an alcoholic, he was a drug user, and he was a womanizer. And that played a big toll in my household. One thing that I realized my dad loved was sports. So that was my number one priority. It's like I had to excel in sports in order to get my dad to smile. When we were outside our home, we was in the community playing sports, I seen my dad light up like the brightest star in the world. And when I watched him watch me play, I could see how proud he was. And I did everything possible to keep that proudness that he wore on his face. My dad tried his best, but he changed. He became a different person. In the home, he was a monster. Outside the home, he was my magical creature, my best friend, the person that I enjoyed being around. And it was just feeling like I was living two different lifestyles. I didn't know how to deal with what I was going through. I didn't even understand what I was going through. I knew I felt something. I felt a sense of fear. I felt a sense of nervousness, but I couldn't understand where it was coming from. I didn't understand what to do with it. I thought, you know, things that I did was gonna change the feeling, was gonna allow me to build that relationship with my father. but nothing I did inside the home worked. I started going outside my home to find things to feel good. And one thing that I started doing was smoking weed, drinking, having sex more often. And these things were allowing me to feel better about myself. But I realize now it was an escape. It was a place where I didn't have to deal with what I was dealing with at home, which was the fear and the nervousness of what my dad is gonna do next. I eventually went to the streets and got away from baseball. I lost my focus on my hopes and dreams. On January 16, 1996, it was just like any other ordinary day for me. I was gonna go commit a robbery for money so I could support my habit and my greed. That was one of the choices that has changed my life forever. I made a choice to go commit a robbery, and in the process of robbing a grocery store manager, he stood up for his right to live, and he was murdered for that. I am responsible for Mr. Soho being murdered, and I received 25 years to life in prison with the possibility of parole. So 2011, right after Thanksgiving holidays, I was transferred to San Quentin. And as driving up on a bus to R&R, I was looking out the window and I seen something that just made me smile and brought this feeling to my heart, my mind, my soul. I could feel it all the way to my feet. And it was just a baseball field. And I remember walking down the stairs, walking past the tables, and just coming down and smelling the grass. But when I took that first step on the grass in left field, everything went silent. All I could remember was the texture of the grass underneath my feet. It seemed like I could smell the dirt. I could smell the crowd, the snack stands. It was like a transcending feeling. And somebody hit the ball to me, and I remember the sound of the crack. It just said, crack. And I'm watching the ball fly in the air, and it's coming closer, closer. I got underneath it, perfect form, perfect technique. And I heard that ball hit the glove, and then at that moment, it was no stopping me. All I kept thinking about was that little kid running around the bases, hitting the balls in the gap, clapping hands with my teammates, and I thought about my dad, you know, how he would feel if he could just come here and watch me play again. My dad is my best friend, and I realized something. If I hate my dad, I hate myself. If I love myself, I love my dad. Because I am my dad. I have the same qualities as my dad. My dad is compassionate. My dad is humble. My dad is outgoing. My dad is loving. My dad is a people's person. And those are the same qualities and characteristics that I display. And I learned that from him.
So that was Cleo Kloman and the story I produced called Restoring Family. Man, that was powerful stuff, man. In the story, he said his father in the household, his father was a monster. You know, I had a stepfather that came into my life at a young age, and he started off like really cool, but then eventually, you know, it got bad. You know, the abuse, you know, the violence. Right. It's a trip to hear Cleo say that he was a different person in the house, because my step-pops was like that. In the house, he was whooping ass. But when he got out there in the streets around other people, yeah. I'm like, this dude act like he was a saint. I'm like damn, man, where is all that at when we in the household? You know what I mean? Right, so yeah. I was in one of these self-help groups, and we had to write an unfinished business letter. Mm-hmm. And so what it is that's like you get a letter and you just write it to somebody, but you don't have to mail it out. So what I did was I wrote my stepfather a letter, and I basically forgave him for everything that took place in my life. So what's your take on it, Shakur?
It's an interesting take to this story is understanding, like, what did our parents go through? Mm-hmm. Like my dad, for instance, like, he was a World War II veteran, and he was captured during the war and tortured,
yeah,
right? Mm-hmm. And he's from the Jim Crow South, right? So in my home, right, like, I would get whippings for, like, missing church.
Like, he would whoop my ass, literally. Right. And he was a barber by trade, so I would get these whippings with this razor strap, ooh, right? And
oh,
his,
man.
Yeah. And man. His mentality was, spare the rod, spoil the child,
yeah,
right? And so he felt like he was doing a good thing. But what has helped me get past that is understanding the trauma that he went through, like what was going on in his life that made him who the person that he is.
For sure, man. Yeah. What resonated with me was the part when he was talking about like this duality inside the home and outside the home.
Yeah.
And that kind of brought me back to like the relationship with my father inside the home. And inside the home, it was the same thing, straight chaos. Like, he was this different person. Like, he was also an addict, alcoholism, PTSD from the war. My father stepped out of my life when I was 12 years old.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I haven't seen him for 20 years, but I recently got a chance to reconnect with him. So one of the things that I brought up to him was like, look, this is how I feel about our relationship. And we need to build this, but it's going to be hard because I'm in prison. However, my son is out there. You need to build this relationship with him. Whatever that we missed when I was growing up, you have a chance to like make amends with my son. Being a father and not being able to like step up like I want to, mm-hmm, I feel like this is the perfect opportunity to have my father step up like he should have.
So, Bun, how do you feel about the topic?
What resonated with me with his story was when he said at the end, if I love myself, I have to love my father. And for a long time, I hated my father because my father was a Khmer Rouge soldier in Cambodia. I never met him. He died in a war. He was a mass murderer. Where we come from, being of that bloodline is a disgrace. And like, you are the cause of millions of people dying. So growing up in the camps, everybody really hated me because they knew who I was. They knew who my father was. When I came to San Quentin and did a lot of programs, and I started understanding him and understanding what he went through. You know, he was a soldier, he's fighting. And, you know, I had to understand that, what he was fighting for, why he left, and I forgave him.
That's deep.
And for forgiving him. And I always told myself, when I have kids, they will know me. They're not gonna guess who I am, what I am, and how I am. So I've been away from my kids all their life, but I keep in contact.
Right.
And sometime when I see my older son, I was like, what is this guy thinking? But then I see me, I was like, what was I thinking? I really never asked my son for forgiveness yet because I'm not out there. When I'm out there, that's when I wanna ask him for forgiveness, because I do feel their pain when they talk to me.
Yeah.
And I do understand it because I grew up without a father.
Yeah, I feel that.
Yeah, man, just knowing that because of the life your father lived,
yeah,
it changed the course of your life.
Yeah.
And he wasn't even there.
Yeah.
You know, so it wasn't like, you know, he was physically abusing you or anything like that. It was just his reputation.
Yeah.
You like, it's basically like you were paying for the sins of your father, man.
I always believed that.
You know, and I just want to just say personally, man, you know, it wasn't your fault. You know, it wasn't your fault, bro.
Yeah.
You know, you can't be responsible for what somebody else did before you were even born.
Growing up, like, I had a lot of resentment towards my father. I felt like Bun felt like I blamed him for everything that happened in my life. And then I'm in this exact same position with my son. Not being there, not supporting him, missing his football, basketball games, missing his eighth grade graduation, first day of high school. And every time that I talk to him, it's like, man, this is my situation. This is what I'm going through. Please forgive me.
Mm-hmm.
If it was my way, I would be there every step of the way. Every moment in your life, I would be there the best I could.
I think that's important for a lot of cats in prison, a lot of men in prison, men out in prison, men out there in society, you know, because I guarantee you, man, if we were to do a poll inside of these prison walls and ask guys who's had a rocky relationship with their father,
man,
I bet it'd be a high percentage, man.
It's like real 90%. High percentage.
Yeah.
You know, but
more,
you know,
more.
We can't take back the pain that we caused. We can't take the pain that we, you know, the abandonment that our children may have gone through. We can't take none of that back. But what we can do moving forward is stay connected.
Right.
Stay connected through letters, stay connected through phone calls, you know, visits if possible. Yep. You know, so so once we do get back out there into the world, you'll be able to rebuild that relationship like Cleo did.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Cleo was able to rebuild that relationship with his pops. So we all have these issues. We all have these father issues. But we have two choices. We can carry on with these issues and continue to go down that destructive path, or we can choose to forgive and heal and move forward.
Excerpt from the show Uncuffed was made by the crew at San Quentin. Chanton Bun, Greg Eskridge, Nate McKinney, Edmund Richardson, Tommy Shakur Ross, and Tan Tran. Our work in prisons is supported by the California Arts Council and the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. The producers fact-check content to the best of their ability, and all content is approved by an information officer. You can hear more from Uncuffed by subscribing in any podcast player. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.